If you ask some of our haters, they tell you that Useful Idiots is a secret agent podcast funded by foreign governments. But you listen to Useful Idiots, you know we're American made. And at a time when it feels like most of our money is being sent overseas to fund weapons dealers, we want to show some support for a company that's doing their best to give good jobs to American workers and really good clothes too. It's American Giant, and since 2011, they've been making high-quality, long-lasting, timeless American clothes, including their classic Full Zip, which was named the greatest hoodie ever made by Slate Magazine. From activewear to work fits to the latest fashion picks, American Giant has it all. Check out the premium Slub Crew Tee, the no BS high-rise pant, and the slim roughneck pant featured in Giant Magazine. While most apparel companies have shipped too much overseas, making cheap disposable clothes and creating complicated global supply chains, American Giant stands for simple, local, high-quality goods. It's the kind of difference you'll feel and appreciate for years to come. When you buy American Giant, you create local jobs in towns that help stitch communities together. Get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use code USEFUL at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code USEFUL. Welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Halper.
I'm Aaron Mattei. Hey, everybody. Thanks so much for being here with us. Our website, as always, is usefulidiotspodcast.com. Go there, support the show, get bonus content, including the Thursday Throwdown, your weekly dose of media madness, and the extended interview of our weekly guest.
Which is going to be really great. Also, Aaron, I like it. Looks like you kind of are sitting in front of a Ukrainian flag. You got the yellow and blue thing going on.
Well, you know, funnily enough, this week we're speaking to Ian Proud, who is a veteran British diplomat. We're speaking to him mostly about the proxy war in Ukraine. So I thought, in honor of this week's interview, I should pick a hotel room that matches the flag of the country we're talking about. So I searched far and wide and found a hotel room where, yes, I'm sitting in front of a wall and drapes, curtain that matches the Ukrainian flag. So yeah, that's how far we go, everyone, to bring you high-level production quality at Useful Idiots.
You're welcome, everyone. And the chair. Yeah. Don't sell yourself short. Also a blue chair.
Also a blue chair. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
So what do we got for our four basic food groups? What do we got for Democrats suck?
For Democrats suck, we're going to turn to Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Remember her? She was forced to resign as the chair of the DNC after the emails from the DNC, the leaked emails, showed that she was rigging the primaries against Bernie Sanders. But that hasn't stopped her from keeping up the fight for democracy, representing Florida, and always being there for U.S. regime change efforts, and certainly there for representing Israel and defending everything Israel does. So as part of that, she went on CNN to speak to fellow Israel, pro-Israel propagandist Dana Bash, and to push an outright lie where Debbie Wasserman Schultz claimed to have seen videos that don't, in fact, exist. And this is on the topic of allegations that Hamas committed mass sexual violence on October 7th. And as we've covered on the show extensively before, the evidence for these claims just is not there. So what did Debbie Wasserman Schultz do? She went on TV on CNN and claimed to have seen videos that aren't real. And the occasion for this was the fact that Kamala Harris recently hosted at the White House a screening of a documentary put out by Sheryl Sandberg, the former Facebook executive, that pushes these claims of mass sexual violence by Hamas. And the documentary contains no new evidence. It just recycles the same claims made by purported witnesses who've been shown to be not telling the truth, as has been documented at places like the Gray Zone, Electronic Intifada, and actually recently for the first time, the Times of London became the first establishment media outlet to catch up with the rest of us and point out that there was no evidence for any of these claims.
There's no video or photographic evidence. They hired like a dark web person to look into it. It just doesn't exist. And Sheryl Sandberg reacts. She doesn't show the audience, but someone shows her on the phone alleged images of things happening. So she also lies in her documentary.
Yes. And by the way, before we go to Debbie Wasserman Schultz, why do we care about all this? Why are we still talking about this issue? Is because these claims are still being made at a time when Israel is committing mass murder with U.S. support. And the point of these allegations of Hamas sexual violence is to basically demonize all Palestinians and justify this Israeli narrative that we can't make peace with these people because they do these horrific things like commit mass rape and sever breasts and commit necrophilia. So therefore, we can't speak to them. Behead babies, exactly. So that's why it's important to call out these claims when there's no evidence for them, because they're used to commit more atrocities. And that's exactly what Debbie Wasserman Schultz and Dana Bash are doing here. And they're doing it by spreading outright fake claims. So let's watch the clip.
Using the White House's platform to make sure that the world knows that Hamas used sexual violence and continues to use it as a weapon of war is violating women, Israeli women. And I hosted a forum with the second gentleman on Capitol Hill a few months ago, and the Israeli police came and showed us videos that were taken by Hamas terrorists themselves, engaging in the kind of sexual violence that Cheryl's film shows, cutting off the breasts while raping their victims, and firsthand accounts from first responders, as well as others and Israelis who were hiding from Hamas terrorists.
Okay, so she's outright lying there. She claims that she's seen videos from Israeli police taken by Hamas of Hamas members cutting off a woman's breast. No such video exists.
Doesn't exist.
Right. Israeli police have confirmed that. That is now well established. So Debbie Wasserman Schultz is outright fabricating a claim. All there is when it comes to these claims of Hamas sexual violence are the accounts of people who claim to be witnesses. But as has been documented extensively, so many of these witnesses have been shown to be liars, including the so-called first responders who she cites there from a group called Zaka, who also spread the beheaded babies claims. They've been shown to be frauds. Even the New York Times, which played a major role in pushing this, had to admit that one of their key so-called witnesses lied. They had to issue that correction months later. So Debbie Wasserman Schultz is shamelessly going on TV and lying. They're accusing other people of denialism for denying things that are lies. And Of course, Dana Bash is giving her a free pass to do that.
Yeah, and tweets it out. Again, Dana Bash tweeted this out. I mean, you'd think that there would be some embarrassment for just lying through your teeth on television. But again, that would require a responsible media that calls out lies instead of regurgitating them.
And again, like, let's say for a second that these allegations are true. Okay. Well, then why then would you not be spending at least equal time on the atrocities happening right now before our eyes with U.S. weapons, tens of thousands of people being slaughtered with U.S. weapons? Why is that not getting as much coverage? And in fact, more coverage than we're getting about these Hamas sexual violence claims.
Or why isn't there discussion of the sexual violence that we know is happening against Palestinians, which was just reported on in the New York Times? Not that you could catch it because it was very low down in the article.
Exactly, exactly. So the point is here, it's not because of any concern with real atrocities, because if there were, there'd be at least equal attention paid to sexual violence committed by Israel against Palestinians and also against all the atrocities happening every single day. But they don't do that. They're only out there pushing atrocity propaganda because they want to justify the actual atrocities being committed against Palestinians. And it's the most cynical thing in the world to exploit dead Israeli women, because that's what's being done here. There are no identified survivors of sexual violence. So what Debbie Wasserman Schultz and other Israel apologists are saying is that all these Israeli women are sexually assaulted. They're all dead. So what they're doing is they're taking the memory of Israeli women, exploiting it to basically turn them into sexual violence victims when there's no evidence of that, to justify creating more victims inside Gaza.
They don't take Believe Women seriously, obviously.
No, they don't, or else they wouldn't be lying about it.
Right.
So anyway, yeah, it's dark, it's uncomfortable, but that's what they're doing, and they have to be called out. Just as they're trying to call out people for denying claims that are fake, we have to call them out for lying to justify actual atrocities.
Now, it could be fake photos and fake videos that they're being shown, in which case I guess they're not lying, but someone else is lying, and they are being useful idiots for liars, but I doubt that.
No, she's lying there about claiming to have seen videos of a breast being cut off, because there's no evidence anywhere that such a video exists. That only comes from the claim of one purported witness whose story makes no sense, because that same witness who claims to have seen a breast being cut off during a gang rape, that was her testimony, also said that she saw three severed heads.
Right.
And then the question becomes, where are those severed heads? There's no evidence of them whatsoever. Israeli police have admitted that. The New York Times, after we called out the Times for printing that witness's claims, the New York Times claimed that Israeli police told them they found three severed heads, but only the New York Times was told that explosive information. No one else has gotten that. The Israeli police haven't said that anywhere else, which leads to the only reasonable conclusion that that was yet another lie. So that's the same conclusion we can draw about Debbie Wasserman Schultz and claiming to have seen a video that there's no trace of anywhere else.
Yeah. I was just suggesting it could have been AI or something, but probably not.
No, it's just imagination.
Yeah, it's just lie. It's lies. Yes. Yeah, it's just lies. Yeah. Well, we're going to shift to some lighter news for the Republican suck. So for Republican suck, let's take a look at this very good investigative Twitter thread from Michael Tracy. So here's the first tweet. A Vermont state legislator got caught repeatedly pouring water into a fellow legislator's bag. Let's take a look at the video. So there, if you're just listening, we just saw someone pour water into a bag. Now we see someone reaching into his bag, discovering, presumably, that there's water in it, walking away, upset. Okay, then we see the same woman go back, put more water in the bag. Okay, now we learn from Michael Tracy that the water pourer is Rep. Mary Morrissey of Bennington, Republican. Wet bag haver is Rep. Jim Carroll, Democrat of Bennington. Apparently the two have known each other since childhood. So maybe you think it's a fun game between friends that are pranking each other. Well, no, let's go to the next tweet. And it wasn't meant as a harmless prank. She apparently did it over the course of months and was only caught by some sort of undercover sting operation. She had to apologize before the entire Vermont General Assembly.
It was conduct most unbecoming of my position as a representative and as a human being, and is not reflective of my 28 years of service and civility.
It was torment. There's no doubt about it, with me anyway. There's going to be some work to be done between the two of us.
What a forgiving man he is.
Very forgiving. It's too bad the name Watergate.
Yeah,
it's already taken because really, right. If this isn't Watergate, then
what is? I don't know
what
it is. But,
you know, I was going to say it is summertime right now. It is hot. So maybe there's something kind of fun about like splashing some water in someone's bag and you know, having them cool off after a hot legislative session. But this has been going on for a long time, including during the cold Vermont winter months. And
good point, Aaron.
Not cool.
You're right. Cool. Yeah. And she didn't claim that either, although that would have been a good idea. All right, what do we got for Isn't That Weird?
All right, for Isn't That Weird, we're going to turn to a reliable source of weird content. That's Donald J. Trump. He's former president, also running for president again. And he recently shared with an adoring audience his thoughts on his favorite curse word.
It was Franklin Graham. He wrote me a beautiful letter, and he said, your speech was so good, and I loved it and everything else, but you don't have to use foul language. And I very rarely do. And it's not really it's just, you know, like little words, like that word that starts with a B and ends with a T, right? Oh, shit. It's just such a descriptive word. I don't know how you replace some of these words. But I think of him when I'm about to do, and usually last speech, I said, I'm going to behave. And I did. I totally behaved. This one, I did use those two words, the same word twice. Biden would say I used three words four times, you know? Remember that?
Trump's favorite curse word, if I heard him correctly, starts with a B and ends with a T. I don't know what you're talking about.
It's BS.
Oh, I see. Okay. BS. That makes sense.
Two words.
Okay.
Or technically one word. Oh, there we go. Is it technically one word?
Yeah. I guess it is combining two words, B and S.
It's a compound.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Fair enough. Well, then, hey, I apologize.
Yeah.
He has his favorite curse word. It is a very common one. It's not a bad one. So, yeah. Okay. Trump's favorite curse word is BS. Good to know.
Yeah. And he whispered it during that. I have very good ears, so I was able to hear that. But it's kind of a weird thing to do, to share with the world what his favorite curse word is.
That's what makes him Donald J. Trump. And that's
why
he might be our next president once again.
Yep. Well, for Isn't That Terrible, let's take a look at Jerry Seinfeld, who, according to the New York Post, totally destroys and owns this heckler who is saying from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. This is what the allegedly very funny comedian said during his stand-up in Australia.
Yes, yes. We have a genius, ladies and gentlemen. He solved the Middle East. He solved it. It's the Jewish comedians. That's what we have to get. They're the ones doing everything. Yeah, go ahead, keep going. They're going to start punching you in about 3 seconds, so I will try and get all of your genius out so we can all learn from you. It's a comedy show, you moron. Get out of here.
So Jerry really thinks this is about him being Jewish, that he's being heckled. No, it has to do with him being a supporter of Israel and its mass murder. And, you know, like, I do tend to agree that comedy shows are kind of like sacred. Like, I don't like the idea of having a comedy show. Yeah. But you know what? At the same time, if you're going to go out and be a supporter of Israel, you know, then you're going to get heckled. It's fair enough.
Some of the things that are terrible about that are that he, like you said, Aaron, is pretending it's because he's Jewish, as if that's what stands out, that he's a Jewish comedian. I think there are other Jewish comedians in the world, and they somehow don't get heckled because it's not about being Jewish. But also, he's just not being funny. Like, that's the crowd work you do? Terrible.
And he's also kind of encouraging violence against
the protesters. Yeah, that too, right. That's another, a third terrible thing, right? Yeah. Telling this guy he's going to get punched, yeah.
Yeah. Well, at least Jerry said something this time. Recall that clip of him recently with Barry Weiss where, like, he was asked about his trip to Israel and why it was so powerful. He just didn't say. He's like, you know. He started crying.
It's true.
He had nothing to say.
Yeah, nothing to say, yeah. Well, it's because he's saving up these zingers like this. He's a man of few words because when he does speak, they're very powerful and they're hilarious. That's why he gets paid the big bucks.
All right, and those are your four basic food groups. For this week's guest, we are joined by Ian Proud. He is a former British diplomat who served from 1999 to 2023. From July 2014 to February 2019, he was posted to the British Embassy in Moscow, where he advised UK ministers on sanctions against Russia. And he's written about his experience with a brand new book. It's called A Misfit in Moscow, How British Diplomacy in Russia Failed. And we're going to speak to Ian about that and also about the state of the proxy war in Ukraine. And he has a lot of really interesting things to share with us about that. So let's go to Ian Proud. Ian Proud, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks very much for inviting me. It's really nice to meet you both.
Well, likewise. And it's great to have you on because you are a veteran diplomat. And there's been some talk of diplomacy recently. With a peace summit, a so-called peace summit convened by the Ukrainian government with its international backers. There's also been Vladimir Putin making his most concrete public offer of peace with Ukraine to date. So I'm curious your reaction to all of this. Let's start with the peace summit. This was a big deal for the Ukrainian government. A lot was riding on the summit for them. What is your assessment of how things went?
I mean, I think you summed it up well, Aaron, by saying the so-called peace summit, because really 2/3 of the representatives there were from European countries or Western allies that have sanctioned Russia. And there's a handful of 27 other countries that kind of signed on to this declaration, including global titans like Comoros and Timor-Leste. But actually what it really proved was that the Global South and like the BRICS group was turned off by this, which they saw as a one-sided kind of echo chamber for Zelensky to really kind of push for his so-called 10-point peace formula, which basically means, please give me more weapons. So BRICS kind of refused to kind of sign that. The Global South too, you know, the whole thing's been kicked into the long grass, quite frankly, and it doesn't really take us any further forward to the actual point at which, you know, peace may be secured, which, you know, will unfortunately, whether Zelensky likes it or not, involve him sitting around the table with Putin.
What do you make of the fact that Joe Biden didn't even show up for this peace conference? And it's not like it would have taken him a long time to get there. He was already in Europe for the G7 summit in Italy. And rather than just stopping over in Switzerland on his way home, he flew back. And Zelensky was very upset by that. He didn't make it secret that he wanted Biden to be there. And Biden didn't show up.
Yeah, and Kamala Harris only actually stayed for a day as well of the two-day event. So, I mean, it says a lot. But then again, the U.S. position is well known, right? I mean, they're going to supply, or well, the Biden administration is going to supply Zelensky weapons for as long as it takes to fight them to the last Ukrainian. So, I mean, that, you know, I think U.S. support was assured. It seems a bit cheap not to show up at all. But, you know, it's not as if we found out anything new about the U.S. position from Biden's absence, or indeed had he been there.
Can you talk a little bit about your experience as a diplomat, and in particular, what you think the media and politicians in the West most get wrong about Russia and Putin?
So there's an awful lot of, fake narrative around Russia. One of the biggest ones, I suppose, is that kind of Russia is this imperialist empire that's intent on invading Lithuania, stroke Poland, stroke Estonia next if they succeed in Ukraine. There's absolutely never been any evidence that was the case, not least because they're all NATO countries, and NATO vastly outnumbers, Russia in its size. I mean, that's one of the kind of biggest fake narratives that kind of really propels the West forward in boosting up its own defense spending, which is already more than 10 times bigger than Russia's, but also kind of maintaining the stance that, you know, we have to keep sending weapons into Ukraine. So that's a big one. There are lots of other kind of weird sub-narratives as well, like, you know, Putin's on the verge of death, and that if we only wait a bit longer, then he'll be gone and the world will be a better place again. I mean, I've been hearing this rumor for a decade, since I first arrived in Moscow in the summer of 2014. He still appears to be in the rudeness of health. Dare I say, possibly healthier even than the president of the US, who knows? But that's another one. Full-scale invasion is another really common narrative that comes in. You know, Russia launched this full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Clearly, they did so with about 160,000 troops out of a total military strength of 1.5 million. So that's not really true. I mean, if you look at any kind of Western press report about what's happening in Ukraine, it's littered with all these kind of narratives around, you know, Yanukovych's downfall in February 2014 as well. I mean, it's just, from my point of view, sort of certainly reading Western media feels much like, frankly, reading the Russian media, ironically.
In Putin's recent speech that he gave to Russian foreign ministry officials, where he laid out his public peace offer to Ukraine, which was basically Ukraine should declare neutrality, as its founding constitution actually once did. So that's not exactly a radical demand. But he also demanded that Ukraine withdraw from all four regions that Russia has laid claim to, even though Russia doesn't fully control those regions. Putin also said, though, and I'm curious your reaction to this, that the aim of the Russian invasion of Ukraine in February 2022 was to, in his words, I'm paraphrasing, was to coerce diplomacy, that Ukraine was refusing to implement the Minsk Accords. Ukraine's sponsors, namely the U.S., were refusing to negotiate with Russia over its December 2021 draft treaty addressing Russian grievances about NATO expansion. And so the aim of the invasion, he said, was to basically impose the diplomacy that Ukraine and its sponsors were refusing to undertake. And it almost worked, because there were negotiations immediately. This led up to Istanbul. As we know, there was almost a deal there until all that collapsed. But I'm curious, I mean, just on Putin's claim about trying to impose diplomacy at the barrel of a gun, do you think that's a fair assessment of Russian goals when it invaded Ukraine?
Yeah, it is. I mean, that's what Putin said. There's no reason not to take him at his word. I mean, if you take a step back to kind of February 2015, when the Minsk agreements were settled, they imposed requirements on the Ukrainian authorities, much like they imposed requirements on the kind of separatist authorities in the Donbass, to kind of move towards some sort of peace process that secured Ukraine's border, but critically actually led to some sort of negotiated devolution in the Donbass, which would give the kind of separatists more of a political stake in kind of self-government while still remaining within the territory of the Republic of Ukraine, right? So the Ukrainian government had kind of pushed forward, and of course they never did, and the US and the UK in particular never really kind of forced the Ukrainians to kind of hold up in good faith their end of the bargain within the Minsk II agreements, which quickly rendered those agreements kind of dead in the water. So kind of fast forward to sort of January 2022, you've got Dmytro Kuleba, the Ukrainian foreign minister, saying, well, we will never offer devolution to the Donbass. I mean, this is what he said. Look it up. I mean, I'm not making it up, but you can sort of read it online. Basically kind of killing or just frankly confirming that the Minsk agreements have been dead for, you know, the preceding 7 years. And, you know, that was one of many reasons, in addition to kind of, Putin's ventures at the end of 2021 on NATO expansion being rebuffed, which, made Putin decide to roll the dice in the way that he did.
In Putin's speech, he talked about actually an episode early on in the invasion where he was speaking to someone he described as a Western diplomat. I think he's talking about Naftali Bennett, the former prime minister of Israel. who asked him about, well, you know, you're in, you have Russian troops, not just in the Donbas, but these two other regions, including Zaporizhia. And he said, well, like, what is your plan there? Do you plan to permanently occupy those places? And Putin claims that he said that actually, if Ukraine could promise us a land bridge to Crimea, then we wouldn't have to be there, basically. That's what I took from Putin's message. And those regions that he's talking about are the regions that he's now claimed to annex. So I'm wondering if you saw in that, that maybe Putin was saying that, well, if Ukrainian troops withdraw from those regions, then maybe we can discuss some arrangement where we just get a land bridge to Crimea and Ukraine could ultimately keep land that Russia has now claimed as its own.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, there was definitely scope to kind of retrench back to the pre-February 2022 borders, including possibly a kind of land bridge through to Crimea, through kind of Mariupol at that time. But of course, that was very that was killed dead in the water as soon as the Istanbul negotiations fell apart upon what we now know to be kind of US insistence, but what we've known for a long time to be kind of UK insistence too. So yeah, I mean, I think that's entirely kind of consistent with the evidence from that time that have come out of the negotiations that were taking place, you know, really from just like a few days after the war actually started in February 22. So, yeah.
As someone who worked for the British government, what can you tell us that isn't already kind of widely known about what Boris Johnson did when he spoke to Zelensky and urged him not to negotiate with Putin?
Well, I mean, you can read what Boris has said himself. He's said publicly that he didn't want Zelensky to take the agreement, and Zelensky didn't. And we now know what the US position on that was. But I mean, what Boris did was entirely consistent with the line that the UK government had been taking for the previous kind of 8 years prior to the invasion itself. So he wasn't sort of swimming against the tide of where the UK policy establishment swamp, if you like, in Whitehall, and actually ministers had been really since the summer of 2014. So there's nothing sort of new that you can elucidate from what happened. He didn't want Zelensky to take it. He said publicly they didn't want Zelensky to take it, and Zelensky didn't. And of course, within weeks, you've got Liz Truss, I can tell you, internally was an absolute massive hawk who just, you know, was seething at the mouth, wanting to punish Russia in every way possible by sanctioning people who weren't politically connected either in the US or in UK oligarchs, you know, and so on. And, you know, from inside of the kind of the walls of King Charles Street at the time, I mean, she would do anything to kind of punish Russia. And of course, you found within just over two weeks after, you know, Zelensky had been the Istanbul agreements, she was actually calling for, you know, Ukraine to then take back Crimea, you know, not entirely clear how they would have done that, which is a line that the US administration continues with today. I mean, Kirby was saying something very similar in a recent interview, for example. So, yeah, you know, from inside of the shed, I mean, Truss was absolutely determined to play the kind of modern-day neo-Margaret Thatcher, you know, with, like, Ukraine being her version of the Falklands, you know, wanting to kind of win at all costs.
And what kind of carrots and sticks were used to get Zelensky to agree?
I don't think he really needed much persuading, to be honest. You know, I think what we had promised him was that we would support, this is the key point, I think, that we'd support him for as long as it takes. This awful phrase, as long as it takes. And of course, what we now know is that actually, you know, it's been taking too long, and Western support for continued weapon shipments to Ukraine has been sort of gradually, slowly kind of withering away. And the future of that remains uncertain, to the point where now actually, you know, the key areas of support that kind of the West, including G7, is supplying to Ukraine is in the form of loans. This infamous kind of 50 billion, you know, using the interest from the kind of stolen Russian assets in Belgium, for example. So we're moving beyond actual handouts to loans, on top of what was already a massively indebted country, Ukraine. And nobody's really thinking long term about what that means for Ukraine as and when, if kind of a war ever stops.
And is what Boris Johnson did, I mean, just as someone who worked in diplomacy, that would have required the go ahead from the United States?
Well, no, I mean, because very clearly in the New York Times kind of story very much confirms that actually what Johnson was saying was entirely consistent with what US policymakers were saying too. And, you know, bear in mind that the UK and US had been in lockstep on Ukraine, right, since the start of the Maidan protest. You know, Victoria Nuland, who had a direct line, phone line into kind of King Charles Street, you know, in Whitehall on this. I mean, you know, we were in lockstep with the US. So there's not a fag paper difference, frankly, between the two positions.
Well, let me ask you about that New York Times article, because it's fascinating. The fact that it's published is extraordinary. So these Istanbul talks are more than 2 years old. According to all parties, they almost had a deal.
I was in that moment in the group of Ukrainian negotiators. We negotiate with Russian delegation practically 2 months, in March and April, the possible peaceful settlement agreement between Ukraine and Russia. And we, as you remember, concluded so-called Istanbul communique. And we were very close in the middle of April, in the end of April, to finalize our war with some peaceful settlement. For some reasons, it was postponed. But to my mind, Putin, this is my personal view, Putin in 1 week after started his aggression in 24 February last year, very quickly understood he did mistake and tried to do everything possible to conclude agreement with Ukraine. And Istanbul communique, it was his personal decision to accept the text of this communique, which totally far away from the initial proposal of Russia, ultimatum proposal of Russia, which they put before the Ukrainian delegation in Minsk. So we managed to find a very real compromise. So Putin really wanted to reach some peaceful settlement with Ukraine. It's very important to remember.
A Ukrainian negotiator said that we found a real compromise and Putin did everything possible to make peace. That wasn't a Russian saying that. That was a Ukrainian negotiator. For the first time, the New York Times prints that Ukrainian negotiator's statement and acknowledges that these talks made real progress after ignoring Istanbul for so long. But now we get a new excuse from the Times as to why they failed. So the Times, first of all, does not mention that Boris Johnson came to Kyiv and told Zelensky, you should keep fighting. They don't even mention that. But we get a new excuse. Now we hear from the Times that according to Ukraine, at the last minute, Russia tried to insert a clause that basically said that if Ukraine is attacked, then if the guarantor states are going to provide military assistance to Ukraine to defend itself, everybody has to agree on their response. And that, Ukraine says, was Russia's attempt to basically veto any future defense of Ukraine against a future Russian attack. Because according to Ukraine, the argument here is that if Russia attacked Ukraine again, Russia could then veto any military response by Ukraine's partners, because under this proposed peace deal that Russia was trying to push through, Russia would have a veto. But the problem with that argument, and I'm curious your thoughts on this, is that the agreement already says that Russia agrees not to attack Ukraine again. That's Article 2. It's like, right, that's the whole premise of this whole agreement. So it wouldn't make sense for Russia to attack Ukraine again and then say nobody can come help Ukraine, because that would be in violation of the treaty. If Russia's already attacking Ukraine, then they're already in violation. And second of all, this is a brand new excuse. We've previously got other excuses. First, we were told that the reason the talks didn't work out was because of Bucha, the alleged Russian atrocities that were discovered in Bucha. But that never made sense, because the talks continued well after Bucha came to light. And then we got another excuse from the top Ukrainian negotiator, David Abrahamian, I think is how you pronounce his name. He said that this didn't work, A, because Boris Johnson told us not to, and B, because we didn't trust Russia. But now we get a new excuse that it's because Russia tried to insert this last-minute clause. So I'm curious your thoughts on whether you think that this excuse is believable.
Look, I don't think it's believable. I mean, I think everybody's trying to retrofit the narrative now to suit their own purposes, right? And, you know, of course, they have to say that after the rather embarrassing kind of leak of these state documents. Look, what is clear is that agreement, you know, irrespective of the issue of security guarantees and which states would have been parties to security guarantees, would have taken NATO membership off the table. And that is and has always been the kind of critical point for Russia, and is the point that it ultimately kind of precipitated. You know, when Russia felt that actually the West was insincere in its desire to kind of find a way around, you know, NATO aspiration for Ukraine, that's really the point at which kind of Russia decided to kind of spin the drum and invade in the way that it did. So it's always been that one issue, kind of NATO membership. And I think actually a deal that took that off the table and sort of set in stone, if you like, or at least set in stone while a longer term peace process took place, the kind of borders, you know, post kind of February sort of 2014, I think that would have taken off the table sort of good calls for Russia to invade again. So I think that's just a kind of fiction as people try to retrofit and paddle quick to kind of make up for this embarrassing leak of US documents.
Your book, which I really recommend, Misfit in Moscow, it has a lot of great anecdotes and, of course, in kind of an insightful analysis. And I know that you mentioned in the intro that there was some censorship that happened. And obviously, you can't tell us what was censored because that would get you in trouble. But I'm curious if there's anything in general you can tell us about the types of information or the type of information that the British government didn't want you to reveal.
So it was anything that referred to the intelligence agencies, specifically the UK intelligence agencies and the operations in Russia. And there was really nothing at all, but even mentioning them by name, you know, MI6, oh my God, you know, can't even mention them by name in the books if they didn't really exist. For example, that would be one. Anything that referred to conversations that happened with actual kind of Russian officials was off limits. So I could only refer in vague terms to kind of people that I knew on the Russian side. And they're a bit shy about anything suggesting that senior sort of, you know, UK diplomats actually might like, you know, senior Russian officials in any way. That caused some sharp intakes of breath. But, you know, really there's nothing substantive in terms of the narrative. I mean, I don't feel I took anything away that actually detracted from what I had to say, but so can't mention MI6, MI5 and that kind of stuff. But, yeah, geez, I mean, it didn't really affect, you know, what I wanted to write about, so I didn't worry that much about it.
Right. I also heard you during an interview with Anatole Levin, you talked about how the sanctions have backfired. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, so, I mean, the thing about sanctions, certainly European sanctions, is that they're kind of a real lowest common denominator thing. You know, the lowest thing that absolutely everybody at the time, a 28-country grouping, can agree with. So lots of countries kind of didn't want things included. SWIFT wasn't included. You know, the big kind of banking transaction service wasn't included. Several banks in Eastern Europe weren't included. You know, the French took a long time to cancel this helicopter carrier deal, this Mistral deal, $1.1 billion. A dollar deal, but eventually did, you know, under sufferance. So the whole sanctions themselves were negotiation, right? So the impact was kind of not as strong as it could have been right from the start. And US sanctions anyway, because, you know, US trade was tiny compared to kind of European trade with Russia, right? So that's one thing. And the second thing, bigger things happened. I mean, there's an oil price collapse at the end of 2014. There was a second one at the start of 2016. You know, COVID happened. All of these things had a far bigger economic impact, you know, on Russia than the sanctions themselves. And actually, Russia has a very kind of capable sort of economic policy making team. You know, the central bank governor, the finance minister are the same people now that they were when I arrived in Moscow in the summer of 2014. And these are not Siloviki kind of KGB diehard, you know, types. These are kind of liberal, kind of economically literate, very capable, very smart people who've been helping the Russian economy navigate those different sort of shifts and pressures that it's been under over the past 10 years. And they've done it incredibly well. And that's and because of that, you know, 10 years, I mean, people think about sanctions in terms of what's happened since 2022. Actually, Russia's been living with them since 2014, you know, 10 years now. They've had a lot of time to kind of reorient their economy, shift it more to Asia and that sort of thing. And they've done a very good job of it.
And I think you talked about a kind of artisanal explosion.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, like cheese. I mean, you know, we had the shrine in the embassy towards all the kind of Western food products that would go, like, you know, Western milk, Finnish milk, for example, very popular, English cheeses and that kind of stuff. It all went off the shelves in the summer of 2014. And there's this big explosion of artisanal sort of cheese making is the example I always use, but also kind of a real focus on sort of pop-ups of culture. You know, all these kind of Soviet-style markets in the center of Moscow were really kind of tidied up, made really kind of trendy and hit with bars, and you get everything, like amazing steaks and locally made cheese. I mean, it was quite remarkable how, you know, Russia decided the strategic areas it wanted to prioritize, agriculture kind of being one of them, and food production, to reduce its reliance on kind of Western food imports. And they just went with it, and they did it actually very, very well. And I have to say, the cheese is also very nice, just saying.
Although you must miss cheddar, right? Or they must miss cheddar in Russia.
I used to bring it back in my suitcase. Yeah, I used to bring it back in my suitcase when I had just, in fact, the head of a sort of big Russian bank told me that when he was a Soviet diplomat in London, he used to bring cheddar back from the horrible imperialist kind of the West when he came back to the Soviet Union from London at the time. So, yeah, nice. Cheddar is a globally a tradable commodity.
Yeah.
One of the few things we have left after Brexit will always have cheddar.
The February 2014 coup, how involved do you think the West was in that, in the overthrow of the Yanukovych government. I'm curious if you also heard Putin in his speech. He talked about an episode I don't think he's spoken about publicly before, where he spoke to President Obama right before Yanukovych was overthrown. And he says that him and Obama agreed that they would support this power sharing deal that was reached between Yanukovych and the opposition that would have left Yanukovych in power in exchange for a power sharing government and early elections. But basically right after that, the hardline faction of the Maidan coup, the ultranationalists, the neo-Nazis, refused to accept it. They carried out more violence. Yanukovych fled the capital, ultimately fled to Russia. And Putin spoke very bitterly about he felt he was betrayed by the U.S. on that, because right after that happened, even though the Obama administration claimed to support the power sharing deal, as soon as Yanukovych fled and a new coup government was pushed through in parliament, despite there being a lack of quorum and parliamentary procedure, the U.S. welcomed it and said that Yanukovych was had lost his legitimacy to rule. And so he felt betrayed, and he said that this led him to suspect that the U.S. was behind all these events. So what is your sense of how involved the West was in what happened during those fateful days of February 2014?
Well, the West was very, very involved in what happened in those fateful days. And actually, the key point about what happened in 2014 is that there's really a tussle between European and sort of US and UK, even though we're still part of the EU, kind of diplomacy on kind of the way forward. Because actually that power sharing deal, you know, was a deal that's brokered very much by the kind of the French, the Poles and the Germans. You know, the foreign ministers coming in and kind of brokering that deal. That was a European deal that they'd brokered. I think, you know, everybody heard the kind of Victoria Nuland, fuck the EU, kind of a leaked telephone conversation, sorry for my language, where it's very clear that she, you know, didn't want the Europeans kind of fouling her turf. She very much saw the kind of US policymakers taking the lead on the kind of future resolution. She wanted to maneuver Arseniy Yatsenyuk into place as a future kind of leader of Ukraine. And hey, presto, he became prime minister after Yanukovych was ousted. So, I mean, that is all kind of, you know, in plain sight, public fact, look it up online. I mean, it all happened because of this kind of big tussle where the Americans felt nose out of joint about this big moment of European diplomacy. And as you correctly said, Aaron, I mean, people just shrugged their shoulders when, okay, I mean, Yanukovych was a dodging, corrupt man, but I mean, Ukraine has lots of dodging, corrupt men and women, let's be honest about it. I mean, as soon as he is out of the way, you know, people shrugged their shoulders and said, well, it's too late now. Let's usher Tory's favorite son into power.
And what's amazing about Victoria Nuland is that's not her only moment of deliberately undermining, you know, European-backed diplomacy to bring peace to Ukraine. So most people now know of the incident we just talked about, where Nuland's caught on tape saying "F the EU," and Yats is the guy we're going to appoint him. We're going to basically support him as the next leader of Ukraine, which is exactly what happens after the coup. But then, so that's February 2014. That's January, February 2014. 1 year later, okay, that's when France and Germany are pushing through the Minsk Accords, which is an attempt to end the war that's begun as a result of the coup that Victoria Nuland backed. But just as the Minsk Accords are being finalized, so Merkel and Hollande are going to Moscow, they're meeting with Putin, they're getting Putin's buy-in on the Minsk Accords. Victoria Nuland is now in Munich on the sidelines of the Munich Security Conference. And she's meeting with a bunch of U.S. officials, including lawmakers like John McCain and Mike Pompeo, who goes on to become Trump's Secretary of State. And Nuland tells them in comments that are not reported in the U.S. media, but they did get reported in Germany. She basically says she's making fun of Merkel and Hollande for trying to do diplomacy with Putin. And she basically says, we're going to undermine whatever they do. We're going to keep shipping weapons to Ukraine no matter what. European diplomats later complained that actually Nuland's very out of sync with Obama, because Obama in public is saying, no, we support diplomacy, we support the Minsk process, we support Merkel and Hollande as they're trying to make peace. But Nuland is basically saying behind the scenes to her own people, like, let's not worry about that. We're going to keep going and keep fighting Russia and Ukraine. And John McCain is there having a meltdown because he's comparing Merkel and Hollande to the appeasers of Hitler back in the Second World War. So were you aware of this during that time, of like just how out of sync U.S. policy was publicly in supporting the Minsk Accords with what Victoria Nuland and her cohorts were doing behind the scenes?
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiotspodcast.com.
That was great. And I got to say, it's a good book. I started reading it. It's really good. It's very engaging. Lots of cool behind the scenes moments from working in diplomacy.
Yeah. And the book again is called A Misfit in Moscow, How British Diplomacy in Russia Failed. Very rare to get an insider, a Western insider, speak critically of Western policy against Russia. And so Ian Pratt, I think, has done a real service here in giving us a different perspective because, you know, as we talked about, right now, everything is so lockstep. Like the U.S. and U.K. are so united behind this path of confrontation with Russia. And Ian Pratt is an insider voice saying, actually, you know what? Why don't we try diplomacy rather than fueling a conflict between the world's top nuclear powers? Something to think about.
If only Antony Blinken could take some inspiration from Ian.
Yeah, not going to happen. No. Antony Blinken can't hear the calls for diplomacy over his guitar licks to Rockin' in the Free World and whatever blues songs he plays sometimes too.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Make sure that you join us at UsefulIdiotsPodcast.com so you can see the full interview with Ian and also get access to our Thursday Throwdown, your midweek dose of media madness. Bye, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at UsefulIdiotsPodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at UsefulIdiotPod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.